No, I know that. Director Vinnie DePaymar and Mr. Gillespie, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairman.
Representative DePaymar, you may proceed.
Did I move the bill or not?
You might as well move. Well, you can move.
Oh,
we can move it, I suppose.
We'll clear the bill then.
Okay.
House File 2877 repeals the current offense of disarming a peace officer, which is part of the obstructing legal process, arrest, or firefighting statute. This offense only applies in cases where the perpetrator disarms the officer of the officer's firearm. And so what we're doing here, members, is we're adding to the definition in this new section that the defensive device includes a firearm, a dangerous weapon, an authorized tear gas compound, an electronic incapacitation device. I'm assuming that's a taser.
Mm-hmm. Could be. Could also be the little handheld model thing. Those are pretty well out of service now. Everybody's playing for
tasers.
It's a taser.
It's cocked now. Electronic incapacitation device, a club or a baton, and any item issued by a police officer's employer to the officer to assist in the officer's protection. As I said in the last committee, that in 2005 there were 230 Minnesota police officers who were assaulted in the line of duty, or about 3% of the officers employed. And I also cited another study that reports that 21% of the attacks involving an attempt to disarm a police officer, 5% of the time the assailant gained control of the officer's weapon. In 30% of those events, the officer failed to survive. So this is a bill that we hope will correct that and act as a deterrent and certainly a punishment in a very dangerous situation for police officers when they are wrestling or fighting with a criminal. I think you have copies of the fiscal note, and if I'm looking at that correctly, it will have minimal impact. So when there is a quorum, I'll be making a motion that the committee approve this bill and send it to the floor. And with me is Bill Gillespie with the Minnesota Police and Chief Officers Association. Mr. Chair, thank you.
You may proceed, Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the time to talk to you today about this bill. This bill is a reflection of a resolution passed at our annual convention in which the membership requested that we make this change in law because of some incidents that have occurred across the United States. It has not been a situation where we have seen a deadly outcome in Minnesota, but that's just a matter of time. This bill is, without going into a lot of specifics, because frankly, Representative Paymar covered it very well, this is really an expression by the legislature, I think, of the special nature of relationship between law enforcement officers and the legislature and the people of the state of Minnesota. We have a group of people that go in the name of the legislature and the people of Minnesota into harm's way. We expect them to do that. We test for it. We background for it. We search out people who are, in fact, willing to do that. But this is a special circumstance in which this legislature, I believe, owes the duty to protect law enforcement officers, and I would answer any questions.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Chairman Paymar. I support the bill. I have a kid brother who's a police officer. I better support the bill. But Chairman, I do think it is prudent for us to make a legislative record of intent here in committee. If you would turn your attention to line 2.4 and 2.5, and I'll read after the second semicolon, and any item issued by a peace officer's employer to the officer to assist in the officer's protection. So, Chairman Paymar, I do believe that the helmet, the vest, the face shield if a dog were issued, and furthermore, that they would fall under these, and furthermore, I don't think there's any restriction as to whether or not these things were taken in a struggle or just removed out of a vehicle. Again, I'd probably support it either way, but I do want to know what the author's intent here is on that section, and if there might be some unintended consequences by leaving that piece as broad as it is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fiskins, the intent is what I explained, that when an officer is in a struggle with a suspect, and that struggle, and in trying to apprehend a suspect, the suspect grabs at any of the possessions that the officer has. Maybe I'll let Mr. Gillespie, who actually drafted the language, respond to it. I know what the intent is, but I see it could be, I don't know if that's...
You may proceed, Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, I think if you look to Section 1-9, which is the first language there, it is a dynamic situation, and it describes a dynamic situation. If the person knew or had reason to know the act created a risk of death, substantial bodily harm, or serious property damage, I think that clearly clarifies the fact that this is an action on the part of some party, not simply removing items from a squad car or stealing them from the officer. This requires an action on that part.
Representative Biskins. Thank you, Mr. Chair. However, I'll have staff clarify this for me by the disarming a peace officer being in a different section of law, with the caveats that are clearly in Section 1, lines 1.9 on down, pertain to Section 2, or would they have to be repeated within Section 2 for it to pertain? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Biskins is correct. The provisions provided in Section 1 of the bill no longer apply to the new standalone offense of disarming a peace officer. And if you wanted those to apply, you'd need to amend Section 2.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I'm really reluctant to wordsmith in committee. If, in fact, the committee were, if it was the will of the committee to amend the bill at this point, perhaps where the reference should be is back in Section 1, referring to the new definition of crime described. Is that possible, rather than tinkering with Section 1 again? With Section 2 again, excuse me, I misspoke.
Representative Wilson, do you have
a point, Mr. Chair.
To this point?
I believe it's to this point. It does say on line 2.7 and 2.8 within the officer's immediate control, and so I think that would take care of it, being in the car, or, I believe that language would take care of it.
Mr. Chair, I wonder I'd like to hear the staff at the end, maybe. Is this overly broad? In your opinion?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, clearly it's a catch-all provision that is, without definition, could be interpreted broadly, and if you wanted to restrict the scope of it, you could simply remove that last clause and limit it to the specific items that are provided. And if there are others that should be included, those could simply be tacked on to the end of the definition.
Yeah, I'm just getting out
of here. Representative Biskin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Representative from Pima, Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to remind the Chair that we don't have a quorum at this time. We can't do any formal action anyway, and it may be good if Mr. Gillespie would go with staff and try and get to the a clearer intent.
Representative Biskin, the quorum just walked in, so no big deal. You didn't see him coming.
Just faster.
Mr. Chair, I'll do whatever the committee wants to do. We can either amend it now, or we can leave the language in place, and I will work with Mr. Gillespie on finding some different language that would deal with this and amend it on the House floor. I mean, that's the other option.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's reasonable. Frankly, from what I've been hearing, I don't really see a problem with the language as it exists. I would hate to sit here and in your request to, in essence, broaden the items, the inclusion of the items, to then turn around and, under the fear of just 7 minutes of jawboning here, to start limiting the scope, I think would be definitely counterproductive. I'm satisfied with the language as it is. Number two, I heard your statement of legislative intent. Three, I heard Mr. Gillespie, and I'm satisfied this bill is language as good as it is, and it'd be up to you if the committee decides just to let you take it out of here and bring it to us as is, or with a change if you decide. That'd be my request.
Representative Paymer, would you like to move your bill at this time? No, we have a quorum.
Yeah, Chair, I'd move House File 2877, and recommendation that be approved and referred to the House floor. And Mr. Chair, I will work with Mr. Gillespie to try to tighten this up a little bit. I think it is a little problematic, and I'm sure we can fix it.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Chairman Paymer, I want to echo the sentiments of Representative Smith. I mean, if it stays this part, I'm fine. I would then just suggest that the title of the section be renamed to Keep Your Hands Off the Cop Stuff.
Don't know
that. So there. Find no fault of that, man.
Any other discussion? Representative Paymer removes his motion that House File 2877 be recommended to pass, return to finance with recommendations referred to the General Registry. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
You're welcome.
I
don't have any minutes. Again, food minutes. I had a food minute, but won't have any food all you want. Are you approving that?
Okay. You have your witness? Members, Representative Benson's witness is not here. I'm assuming that weather is complicating everyone getting to the Capitol, and Representative Simon is not here either. This isn't your witness.
I'll call him.
Okay, so what we're going to do is, if it's okay, is just recess till 9. I think his witness really... Which one?
Yeah,
it's easier. Do you have testimony? How long is your testimony? Okay. Well, let's hear Representative Simon's bill here, as long as we Representative Hillstrom, you're a co-author of the bill. Should we proceed? I don't want to do this.
I think we should proceed. I think Representative Simon would be happy to have us proceed, and I would move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So Representative Hillstrom moves House File 3331, and this is going to the floor.
I believe that's where it's supposed to go, to the floor.
Oh, that's right. There is a fiscal impact here, so we'll have to lay this bill over. For possible inclusion in a supplemental budget bill. Representative Hillstrom, do you want to introduce the bill and tell us what it does? And
Certainly, Mr. Chair. This bill is regarding the shoplifting chains that have been going on, and I'd like the testifiers to come to the table and allow them to make a presentation. We heard this in public safety already. It was a very interesting presentation. So with that, I'll just turn it over to the testifiers.
Okay. Very good. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm Michael Ward. I'm an attorney with Target Corporation. I come to the problem of organized retail crime and to Target Corporation, actually more recently having been a federal prosecutor in Minneapolis for 16 years. And upon my exposure to this problem, I recognized a number of things. This is one of the most under-prosecuted crimes in my professional experience. And there's some important reasons for that. One of them is the sheer scope of the problem. Some other reasons are because of the evolution of the internet economy that is driving this issue. Let me first start with the scope of this issue. One of the things that a lot of people talk about when they talk about addressing a criminal problem that's out of reach is, well, let's make a new crime, let's bring some more resources to bear on this issue. And we at Target Corporation and other members of the retail associations have recognized that we need a new way to think about this problem. Let me first talk about the scope of this issue. My experience, again, as a federal prosecutor for 16 years, the entire federal government, we talk about, like, well, let's bring the resources of the federal government to bear. The entire resources of the federal government bring only about 60,000 cases a year. You might say only, but 60,000 cases a year across every United States Attorney's Office in the country and all components of the Department of Justice. By contrast, the chartered corporation alone apprehends approximately 75,000 people for stealing property from our stores annually. That's with one retailer, which already outstrips the resources of the entire federal government to prosecute this problem. That doesn't include all the other retailers. So what we recognize from these two stark facts is that even if all of the resources of state and local government were devoted to this problem and not to all the other violent crimes, drug trafficking, terrorism prosecutions, we wouldn't have enough resources to address this problem. That's because it's grown out of control from under prosecution. So why is this problem grown at the rate that it has? And there's one explanation for that, members of the committee, and that's the Internet. Stolen property is being sold day in, day out, in plain sight on eBay and other Internet providers. And why is that? Because a seller on the Internet can sell that property in complete anonymity. All they need to provide is the screen name. They don't have to identify the property that they're selling. All of these tools that are available to property fences on the Internet are evading the regulations that this committee and the legislature have imposed on the sale of stolen property. If you were to sell a stolen property in the brick and mortar world, you would have to go to a pawn shop. And because of state law, there are requirements that anyone who sells property through a pawn shop has to identify themselves through positive identification. Some jurisdictions are thumbprint. And you have to identify the property you're selling. But on the Internet, sellers are permitted complete anonymity and the property isn't traced. So as a result of that, if someone wants to sell stolen property on the Internet, they reach an international market in size, and they reap a return that's usually over twice what they can get in the bricks and mortar world of selling stolen property. The net result of this is an explosion of thefts in our stores and from homeowners, and the property is being sold online. One important measure of the bill before you is the ability not to address every single one of these 75,000 people who are stealing from our stores, because we recognize that's not appropriate. Shouldn't be legal. It's a serious matter. But what this bill does is, by adding the crime of facilitation of sale of stolen property, it permits you to choke that market for stolen goods. So this committee has before it a bill which allows you to be more frugal with the limited resources of the state and prosecutors, so that you can target those prosecutions to the fences, to the stolen property market. And by strangling the market, by taking away that marketplace, and by taking away those returns for folks who are selling stolen goods on the Internet, you can reduce the number of people coming into the stores and stealing this property. So what we offer before you in this regard is a way to actually have a smaller number of prosecutions that have a much greater impact, and that's through this facilitation of stolen property provision.
Thank you, Mr. Warrior. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there was questions at an earlier session about a provision in the bill to that would make it an offense to steal property in various formats. For example, by using a fire exit door and by UPC switching. And I'd like to address some of those questions. I know there were questions before, and there's some concerns about the applicability of that part of the bill.
Please do.
One of the other aspects of the technological revolution that is transforming criminal enterprises, in particular organized retail crime, is a tactic known as ticket switching or UPC switching. And it is within the reach of just about anyone with a home computer to have the ability to print your own UPC label and go into a retail outlet and basically set your own price on a piece of property. One of the areas in which this happens most frequently in Target stores is for a vacuum cleaner in the range of, say, $500 or an expensive electric razor. Let's take the example of a Dyson vacuum cleaner, one of the highest value items sold in a Target store. What we'll see frequently is someone will come in and affix a new UPC label that they've printed at home on top of a Dyson vacuum cleaner and that might take a lower price vacuum cleaner that sells for, say, $30 and affix it to that Dyson vacuum cleaner and defraud the store out of that difference. They'll be able to prove that transaction at $30 and take that vacuum cleaner. And there's a net profit there of $470 just on that one item. They'll, of course, take that new-in-the-box vacuum cleaner or razor, and then they'll be able to sell that online at eBay. The bill makes that single act of switching that UPC tag and potentially worth up to $400 or $500 in loss to a retailer and make that an offense. There was some concern that if that bill, or excuse me, that provision of the bill might apply to some dumb kid who thoughtlessly engages in this behavior and buys some small value item. So the question is, can we draft this bill to make sure that we don't cover these dumb kids who might do this, but still address the problem that we face day in, day out, where these professional organized retail crime gangs are engaging in this behavior? And I think that the only solution to try to carve out the problem for the dumb kid is to set a dollar value limit, which raises the amount of loss that will be required to trigger felony prosecution. But we can't have a situation where this behavior is not made a serious offense, including folks who steal property by going out to a fire exit and thereby endangering the public and wasting public resources responding to fire alarms. This type of behavior might be engaged in by dumb kids, but it is the stock and trade and the standard modus operandi of these organized retail crime gangs. And in order to address this problem and constrain it, the law needs to take these serious these tactics, which are so effective, seriously.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Of the witness, I forgot your name, sir.
Michael Ward.
Mr. Ward, if you've got people coming in and switching barcodes and running them through your cash registers instead of at $500 and for instead $30, why should the state of Minnesota change its laws and stop that? Why can't you have your sales personnel be more closely watching so that you don't sell $500 vacuum cleaners for $30? Why can't you have Target shape up their sales personnel to stop that problem?
Mr.
Chairman, Representative Smith, that's a great question. It's certainly the first question that came to my mind when I first heard about this problem. And the answer is that we do spend an enormous amount of effort trying to identify this. There are technologies we've put in place to try to match the, or that we're exploring to try to weigh the items and match them up along the UPC the items so that the item that's priced matches the shape and weight of the object, and we're doing that. And the reason we know about this problem is because we do catch a great number of these. But the real question is, since this is happening with great frequency, why should someone be able to do this with impunity? Because what happens is that a person will come in, put on their own label, and if it's not made illegal, they will keep doing it until and without any consequences of being caught. If the intent of that person is to defraud and steal property without the proper pricing that the retailer sets, they also ought not be able to do that with impunity. So you're absolutely right. We have a great obligation to try to protect our stores. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars to protect our merchandise. We employ armies of investigators. We have two forensic laboratories that we provide service to law enforcement to try to make their jobs easier. So it's a great question, and one which we think we're meeting that obligation to self-help. That is, we need to do everything we can to partner with law enforcement to make their job easier. But in this regard, if we don't make that act a criminal offense, then folks can attempt to do that with impunity, and the instances in which they're successful wouldn't be prosecuted. So what we need to do is have people who get caught doing that have some deterrent that there be a deterrent to that type of behavior.
Representative Smith. Well,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I realize this is not the discussion portion of the question, and I guess the question remains that I have is why can't Target and others just have their own personnel monitor their situation more closely rather than asking for state action? I would hate to think, and I don't think it takes a $100 million forensic lab to stop the sale of a $500 vacuum cleaner for $30 at the counter if you had more observant personnel. I would hate to think that the Target Corporation is asking the state of Minnesota to change its laws so as to protect your profit margin.
Mr. Ward.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, no, that's not our intention. And my earlier answer, if I gave that wrong impression, I apologize. We believe we have an obligation, just as a homeowner has an obligation to lock their door, to have their property not stolen and not be careless. But by the same token, we believe that we should be protected by the laws of the state of Minnesota. And what we've observed is that when businesses are targeted for crime and they are successfully targeted to the point where they're driven out of business or out of communities, that is a consequence for the community itself. We embrace our obligation to protect ourselves and go further, and we offer our forensic laboratories and other resources to law enforcement, not just to protect Target stores. Our forensic laboratories contribute over half of their time on homicide cases and kidnappings that have nothing to do with Target. We believe in being a strong member of the community and offering our resources for the betterment of the entire community. And in this regard, we accept our obligation to protect our merchandise and to be more vigilant. But we would like also to deter that behavior against us and believe it prudent for the committee and for the legislature to recognize that is intentional fraud on the part of those persons who are changing those UPC labels. There's no honest mistake in doing so when somebody brings a UPC label into a store and affixes it on a product. They're obviously intending to defraud, and it's a significant problem that ought to be recognized as purposeful criminal conduct.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, in the 4 years that I've been at the county attorney's office, the surveillance video, obviously there's room for improvement, but between surveillance video and practices that the retailers use has greatly been sophisticated. I do have to say that Target probably has some of the best surveillance video and procedures that I've seen, but Mall of America gets down to the point where we have video of people dropping, you know, a bag into a plant. I mean, it's very sophisticated, but that's not what I want to talk about. I think this is hopefully the right point to say, to tell my story that I told in policy committee, which is there are cases where people come in and in groups where somebody will grab a stack of jeans, go to the changing room, somebody else will come in, and literally this individual had underneath his clothes garters on where he would stick the jeans underneath and walk out, go and sell those on the black market. Stuff like that is very sophisticated stuff, and I do think the retailers have done a good job of partnering up, but I don't disagree with you where this is something where the retailers do bear a lot of the responsibility to assist with law enforcement to see how we can better, and the state, to better protect not only our stores but the consumers too, because as we all know, I just heard on NPR today that iPads are the number one items to steal now. So, I mean, I think we all have a responsibility to work together to solve some of these problems.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to speak much to the policy of this because it's gone through the policy committee and this is the finance committee. But I am surprised that it's before us without a completed fiscal note, because, of course, it is a cost-benefit ratio that we have to be dealing with. If the cost is so much to the retailers, then I would think it'd be to the retailers' benefit to band together for improved research and development in surveillance and monitoring so that these things can't occur, and then it'd be a private sector solution to a private sector problem, and I think that would be most appropriate, because I am interested in knowing what the cost of these increased penalties would be to the taxpayers in Minnesota, and how that balances to the sociological benefits of reducing shoplifting, basically.
Mr. Carter, do you want to briefly talk about the preliminary fiscal note?
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, we do have a preliminary fiscal note, and the first one that completed the fiscal note is the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and they are estimating that in fiscal year 2009, the impact will be 1 to 3 beds, and 2010, the beds will go up from 2 to 5 beds. And, of course, corrections will be putting some dollar figures to that.
Is that to this point, either one of you?
Mr. Chair, I may have a question on this point. If we've heard testimony now on the cost of the state, 1 to 3 beds, 2 to 5. If I've missed it, I apologize. I'd kind of like to hear from Target and or the author what we could expect in 2009 and 2010 as far as reduction of the 75,000 arrests yearly or prosecutions yearly, and how that may translate into lowering the cost of the goods you sell that aren't stolen. In effect, I'm asking for fiscal note from Target and the author.
Mr. Ward, I don't know if you have a response to that, or if Mr. Hillstrom putting you on the spot here, or if Simon's not here.
No, I'm happy to answer it, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Smith. To follow the flow of all that and make that ultimate connection, I think is difficult for me to offer. I think I can connect some fiscal payoff, perhaps even more relevant to the members of the committee, to the state. The estimate is that at the current levels of organized retail crime and this property being taken out of the above-ground economy, that the state of Minnesota is losing, I think the number is $40 million in sales revenue from property that is from UPC switching and from theft of property that isn't going through, not just Target, this is the entire retail industry. And let me offer some other observations. Our investigations show that approximately 60% of our apprehended cases show that the property is being sold online, and then the remainder through different flea markets and other areas that facilitate the sale of stolen property. So through the adoption of the facilitation of the sale of stolen property provision, it is our expectation that you will be able to see a limitation on that market for stolen goods, and that constraint will obviously, when you squeeze the balloon there, that will mean that there will be fewer people with an economic incentive to come into the stores and steal property. If they don't have access to this worldwide market where they can earn 70 cents on the dollar, and instead they're driven back down into the less lucrative stolen goods market, they have to find a back alley fence and they can't sell in plain sight, our records show that our information in partnership with law enforcement shows that they earn approximately 30 cents, or around less than half of what they can earn on the internet. So by reducing the size of the market and the size of the return that they can reap, it is economic principle that there will be fewer of those folks coming into the stores. It is by constraining the market, by being a little bit more efficient with targeting our prosecution resources, that we think we can constrain the number of people coming into the stores. So that wouldn't necessarily change any of the number of prosecutions at the shoplifter level, but it will reduce the number of people coming into the stores to commit these thefts, because they'll have less economic incentive to do so. There will be less return for them, and they'll have fewer people that they can resell the goods to. It makes sense that if you can't resell stolen goods, you only have need for one Dyson vacuum cleaner, and if you don't have very good housekeeping habits, you might not even need that one. So that's our intention, is to try to be a little bit more efficient with the state's resources, and by constraining the market for stolen goods, rather than focusing on the individual street-level offenders.
Smith, maybe we'll ask that question again when Representative Simon catches his breath and comes down here. We don't need you to answer right now, Representative Simon. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, to the point about the fiscal note, I what comes to my mind is that this might have a bigger impact on local jails, and I'd like to know if there's any estimate about that.
Mr. Carver.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, they did not do no local impact.
This point?
Yeah.
Representative Bigham.
They were transferring to a county facility, not a local city thing after the charge. So it would go to the... If it's a felony level, it would be transferred into the...
Representative
Levin. No, Mr. Chair, I'm talking about local jails. In other words, wherever they're held before, other than prison. I mean, let's face it, you know, in Olmsted County, they're held in the county jail.
You're right.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just kind of thinking about the numbers. You said there's 75,000 incidents in Target stores
for the most
Mr.
recent,
Ward.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the most recent full year, we had 75,000 apprehensions in Target stores. That is not in Minnesota. That is nationwide.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
that was my question. How many are in Minnesota?
Mr. Ward.
I'm trying to get that information. I had a preliminary data point which suggested that there were 1,100 within Target stores in Minnesota, which my experience in knowing the number of stores that we have in Minnesota versus our 1,600 store network, I think that number is a little low, and so I want to make sure that that is correct before the close of the testimony today. So I've made efforts to get that number verified, but the preliminary information I have is about 1,100.
And of that 1,500, whatever it is, 1,100, how many of them are minors?
Mr. Ward.
I think the minor rate is certainly below 30%. I think it's closer to 20%.
So
let me clarify too. Although a number of minors are apprehended by our active protection personnel in the store, that does not mean that a prosecution results from every one of those apprehensions. That's the number of instances in which folks have been caught stealing in the store. Certainly, the standard procedure would be to contact law enforcement about those incidents, but as to a rate of prosecution of those persons, probably the experience would vary, and somebody like Mr. Brown from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office or other members of the committee might have a more insight as to the rate in which those juveniles are prosecuted and for what offense.
Mr. Representative
Eastland. Thank you. And of those 1,100, how many of them are going to fall into the $200 or more category that you kind of specified? So,
Mr. Ward.
Our experience in the stores, Representative, is that a $200 item, this is probably unique to Target stores where general merchandise discounter, if you're talking about some high-end store, the proportions might be different. So I'm speaking for Target's experience and not the entire retail industry. But a $200 item is a very high-value loss at Target, and that is not what we see from most juvenile offenders, with one exception. If a juvenile is part of an organized crime ring and they have been given a specific shopping list of items to steal, and is part of a coordinated ring where somebody pushes the fire alarm or somebody is distracting the store security personnel while some others dash out the store, it is not uncommon that a juvenile would be involved in an orchestrated operation like that, in which case the dollar value would be high. I offer that context to contrast it with the dumb kid hypothetical that has been suggested. We don't see single offender juvenile stealing $200. I would suggest that is a sub 5% type experience for us.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Eastland, then Representative Coles, and then we have a couple more witnesses, and Representative Simon is here also. So, Representative Eastland.
Yeah, but my question was, how many of the 1,100 are $200 or more?
Oh, pardon me.
Mr. Ward.
I'd be happy to offer a written response to that, but I know in the committee's interested. I think maybe in my educated guess to that response, I believe the $200 is probably, let's say, probably 70% of our incidents and apprehensions in the store would be more than $200. Excuse me, 70% would be less. 70% would be less than $200.
Representative Eastman.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and I guess just this is kind of a comment. I guess it's a little disingenuous, in my view, to come in here and talk about $75,000 thefts and 75,000 incidences and how a problem that just seems insurmountable. And when we get down to it, we're talking about probably 300 or less incidences in Target stores, and we're going to change state law. And I think that's just an issue that we should be thinking about here. It's prevalent. We're concerned about it. But we do go back to, is this something that rises to the level that we should be changing state law and risking, even if it's only 5% of the cases involve juveniles, we're going to give those juveniles felony records that they're going to have to live with for the rest of their life. And so I think this is, it may make sense. It sounds like it's probably a good thing that would help Target to be able to manage their stuff. But I guess from a policy perspective, I think there's some deeper implications here that we need to be thinking about when we start looking at the real impact and how many cases this actually involves. And is this something that we should be changing state policy, or should we be looking at better enforcement on the Target side? I'm not saying one or the other is necessarily correct, but I guess I'm a little concerned that the problem was pumped up to be this huge problem, and in reality, when we see it, the numbers are very, very small. And I understand it's important to Target, but I think from our perspective, we want to make policy that's good policy, that's not going to be injurious to a lot of young people who would then have to face felony records for the rest of their lives. So it's just an issue that I think we should balance and we should understand.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chairman, members, I absolutely support the direction this bill is going, but I'm not sure that some of the issues that were raised by Representative Holberg, I may have commented on them or not, were really have been addressed yet. And Representative Simon, I really do want to support your bill, but you know, it's not just the $200 piece. If some dumb kid, and we'll use that dumb kid example, his buddy is in one of these crime rings, and he happens to find one of these UPC symbols, and he switches out puts a $30 UPC tag on a $60 pair of jeans, they're subject to felony penalties under this bill right now. It's not just if you steal $200, and I'm concerned that. This is a problem, and maybe some of my colleagues don't quite agree that this is something we should be doing as a state. I happen to think that your bill is headed in the right direction, but I'm concerned I'm not going to be able to support it unless we take a look at that subdivision 19 and the penalties. The penalties associated with somebody flipping that out it's not $200 if somebody does it once. At one time with a UPC change, and that's a felony, and I'm not sure that we really want to go there. So, Representative Simon, I hope that as I understand, we're going to lay this over, Mr. Yeah. Chair, and so Representative Simon, if we're going to put this in our crime bill, I hope you're willing to address that, because otherwise, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to support it.
Representative Simon,
thank you, and members,
apologize
for being late. Normally, a 25-minute drive took me an hour and 10 minutes. There was a rollover on Highway 94 for those of you who came from the west. So I mean no disrespect, and thank you for pinch hitting Representative Hillstrom. As a result of my being late, I don't know what's been said yet or not. So forgive me and give me the hook sign if it's been repeated already. But this is a big deal, and Representative Eastland, this is not a Target bill. I'm not doing this at Target's behest. I actually came to the retailers; they didn't come to me because of what I've seen in my other life and my other job happening. And so, while particular language may or may not benefit Target, I can assure you, from my standpoint, I'm not here doing Target bidding or Best Buy's bidding or any particular retailer.
This is a $40 million price tag in Minnesota, and I'm sorry, as a result of my being late, I didn't have the handout that the policy committee had, but according to the latest estimates, this cost us $40 million in lost sales taxes in Minnesota. And you're going to hear in a minute, and I want to be careful because I know there's a lot of other business, you're going to hear from other retailers, including grocers and others who support this. This is a big deal because, as may have been said in introductory remarks, online auction sites such as eBay, through no fault of their own, are becoming the biggest sort of fencing operations in the world, and this is creating a real...
We've heard a lot of this testimony already, so
okay.
if you don't mind, I think that we have another bill up, and we have two other people to testify,
sure.
And we have three members who have questions.
One thing precisely to the point that Representative Eastland and Representative Coles have mentioned, we are trying to tweak the language to resolve the dumb kid problem. In fact, I can tell you, you know, this is a fast-moving session. 10:30 today was the first time we could get a stakeholders meeting. Everyone's invited. The defense attorneys are welcome to come to this meeting. We're meeting in the MnDOT cafeteria. All of you are invited. And we're going to go over the precise language that we really need to get it right. But that's the first time we can arrange the meeting is 10:30 today. So make sure we can get around that. That's all I see, the assurance I can give the committee.
Mr. Chairman, this is kind of a personal thing, so I'm just going to ask for an answer in writing. To the testifier, you said that you have a strong community partnership and a community member. You want to be a good member of the community, but please give me an answer in writing. I don't find anybody high enough up on the food chain in Target, so it's good to have you here today. You are the only store in Mankato, Minnesota, the only retail store that at Christmas time doesn't allow the Salvation Army bell ringers to stand out front. And your store manager gets snippy when I talk to him and says that they're annoying the customers. The only huge retail store, and that's not a very good community image. And if you could just give me an answer in writing why you have that policy. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. This comment's going to be quick because I've been Senator Simon covered it. But I think we need to keep in mind that Target's the first witness, but this is a statewide problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is for Mr. Ward. Mr. Ward, are you aware that this committee last year decriminalized theft and jacked it up to $1,000 for felony? Are you aware of that?
Yes, I've heard that.
Mr. Ward?
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, yes, I'm aware of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ward, do you have an opinion on how that would impact, that law change would impact your efforts to stem retail crime?
Mr. Ward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think for some of the reasons that I've described and the structure of these organized retail crime rings and how they recruit these boosters to steal this property, that enables the operation of these organized retail crimes and inhibits our ability to do so. The structure of the bill proposed tries to limit the applicability to these organized retail crime rings and not make general changes to the criminal code by trying to target the organized retail crime context.
Mr. Chair, can I just do one comment?
What?
Thank you. My point is, Mr. Chair and members, that I don't necessarily share Representative Cole's concerns about the dumb kid problem. First of all, if you're switching UPC codes on a product, you're not a dumb kid, and maybe you need to be pinched. Now, these retail crimes are like a river that flow through county attorney's offices, and they pick and choose which kids out of the river. It's kind of like bobbing for apples, and it's about the same success rate, too, I might add. And a lot of the rest of these things filter down, so I don't think that we're going to see kids having the same felony records that maybe some people are concerned the language of the bill might suggest.
I have a quick question before I get to Representative Hodge. Am I reading the bill correctly that if someone stole retail property of more than $51, and went out an emergency exit, that would be a three-year felony?
That's the provision. The intent of simultaneously lowering the threshold for the use of the emergency exit to reflect the danger to the members in the shopping public and the expenditure of public first responder resources who are called to these stores when the
where the perpetrators are causing a diversion and expending time and effort of the first responders who respond to the alarm. Again, the balance being to deter the behavior, which has greater societal impact, but to try to set a threshold. The dollar threshold is not entirely arbitrary, but obviously is more successful to change. The important or more significant consequence there is the expenditure of first responder resources, which we believe makes that conduct worthy of greater punishment, and the need to deter that behavior.
Representative Haas,
I don't know about flowing rivers and bobbing for apples or whatever. I mean, that almost changed my mind on these things. You know? But I do have a concern that we're going to capture an awful lot of people with a felony charge for something that really doesn't have a felony nature. And we were working last year, as was pointed out, removing some of those so that they were being treated in accordance to the crime that was being committed. And I have no problem punishing people with felonies for felony things. But I think we have some loopholes in here that we're going to be punishing people for a lifetime for some stupid act. And I don't think they're going to be of the criminal nature that we think of. I think they're going to be ponies and dumb kids, if that's what we're referring to it. And it's going to be a lifetime of punishment for them, not being able to get housing, not being able to get jobs, and just suffering an awful lot for some act. And I think we should be very careful what we're doing here.
We have two other witnesses. If you'd like to provide, Mr. Simon, you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jamie Poole, president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. The MGA is a trade association representing the food retail industry since 1897. We have over 200 retail members and nearly 1,200 stores statewide, as well as approximately 115 distributors and manufacturers. Our member companies employ over 85,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. As you've heard, organized retail crime is a serious problem facing the retail community. Again, to reiterate, $334 billion annually. These crimes ultimately lead to inflated prices for consumers and lost sales tax revenues for the state. In the grocery stores, the items that are frequently targeted by these organized retail groups are small, inexpensive household items, such as over-the-counter drugs, baby formulas, razors, batteries, which are commonly sold in all of your communities. These products, after they are stolen by these professional shoplifters and boosters, are then resold through internet, fencing operations, and flea markets. This is different than petty shoplifting and presents a potential hazard to consumers. Grocers and manufacturers take very seriously the integrity of the products they make and sell. This unscrupulous way of selling stolen products results in package tampering, alterations of expiration dates, and it creates a dangerous and compromised product for consumers. This is a great concern to grocers. The MGA works closely with their local law enforcement to put all the appropriate measures in place to reduce risk and create safer shopping experiences, as well as extensive in-house training and educating of its staff. It is simply not enough to combat the problem of this magnitude. I'll keep it brief. So in closing, we believe this committee can do a great service to Minnesotans by supporting this legislation and recognizing retail organized crime and assign appropriate penalties to the severe nature. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is Mr. Buzz Anderson here? We have a letter.
Yeah, we have a letter from you.
Representative Simon, do you have any other testifiers?
Okay. Yes, one more live testifier. In absentia, we have support also from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and the Minnesota Chiefs of Police.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, because that's what the world needs is more live lawyers. I'm David Brown. I represent here the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I want to thank Representative Simon because he has brought us in on this bill. As you mentioned, we're going to have a meeting here at 10:30. The County Attorneys Association is certainly supportive of the idea, particularly targeting these groups of shoplifters that come through our communities and devastate not only our retailers, but the consumers who get the increased prices as a result of that. So while we have some questions regarding some of the language in here, we want to thank Representative Simon for his willingness to work with us, and we are certainly supportive of the concept.
Thank you for your testimony. So, Simon, do you have anything else to add? Only to say, obviously, we're going to need to tighten the language. We all know that. And I think members, I think those who have brought up the concerns, I have the same concerns. But in a very fast-moving session, it's difficult scheduling-wise. Ideally, we would have had the language here today, but we want to get it right. And I understand this bill is going to be laid over, so hopefully that will give us the opportunity to make it right. None of us here want the dumb kid to have a lifetime stigma. We're after the professional boosters and the people who are really causing the problem.
Representative Simon, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the bill, but let me just say that there was widespread concern about the bill, and for lots of different reasons, and I hope that that's all conveyed to you when you meet this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in favor or in opposition to the bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brock Hunter. I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I've just arrived. I understand that there has been some concern voiced about this bill, so I will just limit my comments to the thresholds that are proposed. The bill proposes a new felony level of theft, the three-year, $8,000 felony level, with, from our standpoint, very, very low thresholds, $200 threshold, and $50 if the person leaves through an emergency exit. Our concern is that just this last year, this committee and the legislature raised thresholds for theft crimes for the first time in 20 years, and the proposed thresholds in this bill would not only eliminate those increases, but actually dial it back to even lower thresholds than existed prior to last year. And we would see that as counterproductive in the larger scheme of things. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. So Representative Hillstrom will renew her motion to pass House File 3331, and the chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. Representative Murphy, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, this is for future. I really resent the term dumb kid. I think it's dumb action, but not dumb kid.
You have all been admonished, members. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Thank you, Representative Simon, and all of your testifiers. Representative Benson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I am live, and I have two live testifiers with me this morning.
Mr. Representative Benson, just one moment. The chair will move House File 3175 for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. Mr. Benson, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I appreciate in this busy session that we have that you were willing to hear my bill. And we have a fairly simple bill in some ways. It may have ramifications which we need to discuss here in this committee and elsewhere, I suspect. It grows out of an incident which took place in my affecting one of my constituents and Senator Bonoff's constituent, Monica McIntosh, and Monica will be presenting her story, a very compelling story. And my second witness is David Brown, who will be representing Hennepin County District Attorney's office. So I thought, if I may, with your indulgence, go through the bill very briefly and then ask Ms. McIntosh to make her comments. Also, you should be receiving a fiscal note with this bill. We have a situation in which certain kinds of attempted robbery in this case involving motor vehicles, receives a lesser sentence than hijackings or motor robberies that are successful. And the situation that Monica will discuss here will kind of illustrate why this is a problem in our view. So we are attempting to do two or three things with this bill. Under the first section, 609.24, under simple robbery, we are asking that the law be changed so that attempted robbery, a personal property, in this case the automobile, receives the same penalty as robberies that are successful, or hijackings that are successful. In 609.245, aggravated robbery, we're asking again that attempting to commit these robberies with the use of dangerous weapons receives the same penalty as what is on the law, what's in the books now, with successful hijackings or robbery. And so those are the basic issues that we are presenting here today. And if I may, I would like to introduce Monica McIntosh, who will give a brief commentary.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Monica McIntosh. Thank you for hearing me today. This incident occurred to me while engaged in something we all do every day, in fact did this morning, and that was drive on 94 from Minneapolis to St. Paul. In broad daylight, this man tried to run my car off the road from the left side on the freeway, 55-60 miles an hour, with cars speeding by, and he eventually pushed me all the way to the shoulder. He then pinned me in where there was nothing I could do to get away. I tried to back up and ran out of shoulder. He then got out of his car, a bloody rag tied to his ankle. I had no idea if this was someone who had a gun, had been shot, was trying to get away. Came to my window and about 5 inches from my face, tried to break my window, screaming obscenities, trying to open my car door, which luckily for me had been locked. My windows were up because there was not time to do either of those things. He could not get in the car. He went around to the front, pulled off the medallion, threw that at the windshield, trying to break it, I assume. Panic. Nobody stopped. I'm there alone. I'm pinned in that car. Not a clue what to do and what was going on. He then went back to his car. I didn't know if it was to get a gun, to get a bat, or to drive away, and luckily for me, he did drive away. I just want to say to you that certainly this is nothing I do. It's come here to testify and take the time and try to push something through that I'm very unfamiliar with, but I do it because this is bigger than me. Thank God my child hadn't been in that car. Thank God that we didn't cause a multi-car accident on the freeway doing this maneuver over to the shoulder. Thank God, like the woman that was thrown on the highway Thursday when I was here at this table testifying, that my car doors were locked, that I did not get out of that car, because I'm positive that's where I would have ended up. When I went to court for the sentencing for this man several times, who played all kinds of games with our court system, he really got a slap on the wrist and a few days in jail. And by the time I got home from the last sentencing hearing, I got a recorded message that he had been released, because all the time that he took trying to get psychiatric evaluations in the jail, they put towards his time for this crime. So I don't know exactly, but I believe it was roughly 60 days that he spent while he was trying to say he was insane and didn't understand English and blah, blah, blah. So as I'm sure you can understand my thought, that after almost killing me several times over, that was the extent of his sentencing. And this is why I tried to go further with this, because I'm just astounded that that was it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Do you have another witness?
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if you might also discuss, if you would, in, you know, briefly, some of the psychological effects that this incident and other instances had with you before we go on.
Yes.
Ms. McIntosh.
Thank you. This was a re-injury for me. I was assaulted when I was 19 and have spent thousands of dollars in therapy and several self-defense courses trying to regain a sense of safety, which is exactly what this man stole from me that day. That if I can't be on a major highway in broad daylight, thinking I'm safe to get to my destination, you know, where can I be safe? So it has really added to the post-traumatic stress of this event on top of another.
Thank you. Do you have anyone else that wants to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Brown, again, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney. I was asked to speak to the policy. Why would we want to make an attempted robbery the same as a completed crime? And that's certainly a legitimate question. And the answer is that the harm, the horror in what Ms. McIntosh went through, the harm that we're looking to punish happens when they come to your window trying to get your car, smashing it. It's when a store clerk has the gun put in their face, not whether they get a nickel or a dollar or $1,000 or your purse. The harm, the emotional harm, the crime happens when the force or the threat is made, and certainly with a weapon. And so when we as prosecutors look at the policy of that, we had one of our very most aggressive prosecutors prosecuting Ms. McIntosh's case. The most we could come up with to charge that defendant with was attempted simple robbery. It's a probationary case anyway, but if he messes up on probation, the most you're going to be able to imprison him for is half of what the completed robbery would have been. So there were strong policy reasons to enact this bill. And as to the auto, I know from Senator Bonner's office, the thought was that especially where this is happening on the freeway, but even where a robbery is happening to somebody in their car, a carjacking situation, we have a limited ability for that victim to get out of the car, to get away. You can't run away. You're trapped essentially by your car. And if the car is moving, you're endangering other motorists, pedestrians. There's an enhanced danger in doing a robbery with where the victim is in the vehicle.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Brown, we all heard the testimony of Ms. McIntosh, and that was angering me to hear, if the facts are as I heard them, that the person essentially got off or by treatment. Can you tell me, as county attorney, how that person, that actor in that scenario, would have been treated in court under this law had it been in effect?
Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, the completed crime, if this bill goes through, it still would have been a probationary sentence. I will tell you that judges viewing a completed crime of robbery, even in a completed simple robbery, are likely to treat that more seriously. That is, would I say that person would go to prison? No, you're not going to have that. Because we didn't have the weapon in that case. But you're likely to get a much longer jail sentence. And importantly, if that offender, while on the 3 or 5 years of probation, violates the terms of the probation, they're not going for half of the sentence. Because simple robbery, the completed crime, I believe the sentence is 21 months. The attempted simple robbery, year and a day. So even if they violate probation, and so what we would be getting is additional time hanging over their head. For the aggravated robbery, you get a significant penalty right up front.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So, help me understand your answer. In that case, it sounded to me like you said that person would have, sounded like he got 60 days or less, at least credited with that time. Would he have had, would there have been more time in jail, number one, or not? Number two, would, what would the probation, how would the probation have differed under this? Number two, and that's the question.
Okay,
Mr. Brown.
I can't speak exactly to what the judge would have done differently, try and revise in history. I can tell you, based upon my experience, a judge sentencing for a completed crime of robbery, had it been different, you would have had longer than 60 days. If that was the sentence, 60 days, you would have had longer than that. Based on our own experience. I can't tell you exactly how much because that varies from judge to judge, frankly.
So I think, weren't you asking if this law was in place, what the sentence would have been?
If this law was in place, it still would have been a probationary sentence for the amount, and maybe where I'm not communicating well is the attempted simple robbery that was charged in this case, in Ms. McIntosh's case, would have still been a probation offense. But not all probation offenses are treated equally. That is, oftentimes, judges looking at what should I give as a jail sentence for probation will view an attempted crime more leniently than they view a completed crime. So under this bill, a judge looking at that sentence is more likely to impose longer jail time.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for asking another question, but thank you for the leeway to do so. Mr. Brown, are you familiar with the individual that she described and his or her, his previous criminal record? And I'm curious if this law, had it been in effect, would have resulted in a probationary offense, which is what he got anyway, I'm hearing. Had that person been on any kind of probation prior to doing what he did to Ms. McIntosh?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I apologize. The prosecutor who actually handled the case, Hillary Caligiuri, couldn't be here today because she's in trial, and so I am not aware of this offender's particular criminal history. I can't speak to that. I can tell you based on my experience that if he did have a significant felony history, it would be highly unlikely that he would have gotten that 60-day kind of sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to return to this statement that you made about the harm happening when initially, and trying to get rid of this distinction between an attempt and a completed crime. And I want to start out by saying, first of all, ma'am, I mean, your story is compelling, and there's no doubt, I'm sure nobody here at all doubts the impact that this event had on you, and I hope you understand that our discussion about this is certainly not about that. But if we operate under the theory that, and it is kind of a fiction in law, that people are aware of possible penalties, you know, that you don't steal because you know that you're going to get some penalty for it, then I think there has to be sort of an idea that people know that there's a difference between attempting something and completing the crime. And while the impact on the victim might feel pretty bad just an attempt, you know, it troubles me that we want to blur that distinction, because I think then the signal you might be sending is, go ahead and complete the crime, because it's going to be the same anyway. Do you want to respond to that?
Representative Benson, do you want to respond to that? Or Mr. Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I was writing a note. Maybe you would be willing to respond to that.
Mr. Chair, I understand the point you're getting at, the whole notion of this blurring the line between an attempted crime and completed crime. I will tell you that in my 20 years of prosecuting, I am unaware of a robber with a gun, or even in a simple robbery situation, stopping halfway through because, oops, I don't want to commit the completed crime. I think that becomes more of a policy distinction in terms of, do you want to imprison these? It really becomes more of a judgment as to how you want to treat these, a policy decision. But in many crimes, theft crimes being an excellent example. The harm to the victim comes in large part by how much they actually got. That is, the harm wasn't that it was a bad check, it's that it came out of your account in the amount of $30,000 instead of $50. Whereas here, when you put the gun in the clerk's face, the harm, the policy theory is that the harm is completed at that point, not whether they take a candy bar along with it.
I'm going to have Mr. Carter. Sometimes we're running out of time.
Yes, thank you. I just might want to also comment. There is a perception that I think is important for people who are suffering, who are the victims of these kinds of acts, that there is a sense of justice, that they received their due respect from the society, and society has provided a just result for the victims as well. And I suspect that most people who commit crimes do not, you know, stop halfway through and think, well, this would be a bad thing for me to do. Thank you.
Before we discuss the fiscal note, is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition to the bill? Mr. Hunter?
Mr. Chairman, while he's coming up, did the author ever notify the public defenders on this and what their input is?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I spoke in here briefly just this morning with John Stewart, who is public defender, and last night I visited with Bob Ellingson. Both of these gentlemen are here. They would rather not, unless they change their mind, testify on this bill. But I would want to say that Mr. Stewart made it clear that they are in opposition, or he is in opposition, the group he represents, and they feel that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission might be a better venue for dealing with these kinds of issues.
Representative Cornish, and then we'll hear from Mr. Hunter. Who is the question to, or is it a comment?
Just a comment.
Can we hear from the opposition first?
Sure. Then?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brock Hunter with the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I want to just quickly start by saying I don't want to in any way detract from the trauma that Ms. McIntosh, I'm sure, experienced in this incident. I can't imagine the fear that she must have felt. In hearing her story, though, it strikes me that there were a number of major crimes committed that could have been charged in this case. The use of a motor vehicle to force her vehicle off the road at high speed, I have seen in the past charged out as a felony assault, the use of a motor vehicle as a weapon. Coming up to her window and threatening her as a felony terroristic threat. Testimony from Mr. Brown talks about wielding weapons, guns, knives, in the course of attempted robbery. The wielding of any kind of weapon in any kind of threatening manner is a felony second-degree assault with a presumptive prison sentence. There are laws on the books that are already there and meant to punish people who use these kinds of extreme behaviors in attempted robberies. I don't know the specifics of this case beyond what I've heard this morning. I don't know why those charges were not filed in this particular case, but it strikes me that that would be the way to go in this particular situation, and those carry much heavier penalties than robbery or attempted robbery.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not going to launch off and pontificate on the whole castle doctrine here, but I want you to remember this when we get into this hearing, if we do, on the castle doctrine, that the best deterrent to a criminal in this situation is knowing he's going to get his damn head blown off. When he's not going to think about court, he's not going to think about the fine, it's his fear of loss of his life. And in this instance where a woman was terrorized, that's why I'm for empowering the citizen. She could have been the best defense of her own that day. I think she's taken some procedures since that's happened to defend yourself, but I won't launch into that now.
Mr. Carter, you want to give us an overview of the fiscal note?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, we have a preliminary note. Basically, Sentencing Guidelines have completed their part, and they're saying this will result in 8 correctional beds in fiscal year 10, fiscal year 11, 26 beds, and by 2015 it will go up to 54 beds.
And the cost of?
We don't have a cost. The corrections has not completed their part of the fiscal note, but we should be getting that within the next couple of days.
Okay. Do you have any closing? Mr. Stewart, did you want to testify or not? Real briefly, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I hadn't intended to testify about this. I appreciate the opportunity to make one point here. My name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. I'm particularly concerned about the part that would specify a 50% increase in the sentence. It seems to me that you've got the Sentencing Guidelines Commission set up to make sentencing law consistent and proportional. And constantly there are going to be horrifying instances that are going to come up that will be presented as creating a necessity for the legislature to step in and add 50% or double it or whatever. And pretty soon the result is that your Sentencing Guidelines Commission starts to lack a sense of credibility and mission, and the chart that is supposed to be holding all these sentences in a proportional, worked out, systemic manner becomes full of holes because of particular cases that led people to step in and say, well, this is going to go up 50%. So I don't know whether it's a good idea for this penalty to be increased or not, but I would respectfully suggest it would be a good idea to ask the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to look at it rather than to just sit here and do it as a legislative matter. In addition, if there's a particular case that's particularly bad, the judges are empowered to give double or triple sentences in a particular instance. So there is the sentencing departure process by which people can get an increased sentence if they do something in a particularly bad way. That, again, is part of the guidelines.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you. Thanks for talking with me about this.
Representative Benson, you have close. Final words?
Yes, just a few brief comments. Again, we're running late. Just a brief observation, not a rebuttal to the last two testifiers that I'd like to make, and not to cast a burden on any municipality or police agency or court. But it's been my observation that sometimes it depends on where one of these crimes takes place. In an area where the police and the courts are very heavily engaged and resources are scarce, when they are faced with an incident which did not lead to direct bodily harm or death, they, in order to clear the deck, I think, sometimes will move those cases on with minimal impact as far as the courts and the police and the prison system and so. In my district, if someone scratches your car, it seems like within an hour or two we have three police cars. And they're taking all kinds of testimony, and they're running down through the park to find whoever did it. And so there may be a facility in intervening in this regard to send a message to those municipalities where, because of pressures that they are facing, they need to take more seriously what I think most people in our society would consider very, very serious crimes. So thank you very much for your time, and I want to thank Ms. McIntosh for her bravery in coming here and dealing with this.
I make one comment.
Go ahead, Ms. McIntosh.
As Mr. Brown stated, I had a really strong attorney. She told me this was the only thing she could charge him with. I want you to know there was a second victim that day, a man, that decided not to come forward and spend all the time as I did in the hearing. The fact that I'm here today is because that Hennepin County attorney told me this is what would have to be on the books to charge him further, okay, and why I took these steps. That, once again, I can't believe that's all he's getting for almost killing me and several other people.
Thank you, Ms. McIntosh, for your testimony, Representative Benson. Thank you. This meeting's adjourned. Excuse me. I need a motion to...
and I need, we had to adjourn the meeting, didn't I? Okay, you didn't hear anything?
I didn't hear.
I will move House File, 3175 be laid on the table. Now this meeting is adjourned.